Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. I'm Alex Andreu, and here with me this Monday morning in the wet, soupy gloom is Time columnist Yasmin Serhan. Morning, Yasmin.
Morning, Alex.
Yasmin, let's begin with a little bit of UK politics. The Sunday Times yesterday had a scoop that the government is exploring a Swiss-style bespoke EU deal with fuller access to the single market, closer alignment and freer, although not free, movement. And this seems to have excited Tory backbenchers quite a lot. Mm. Is there anything to it?
Well, if you ask the government, they say there's nothing to it at all. They've categorically denied that they're seeking a Swiss-style relationship with the EU, I think especially after the sort of Brexiteers within the Conservative Party kicked off on Twitter. And of course, you had the sort of normal characters. I saw Nigel Farage call Rishi Sunak a globalist, which was an interesting... sort of critique there. It effectively, it suggested to me at least that if there is any merit to the story, and I believe the FT has and the Sunday Times, they basically confirmed that their reporting was quite strong on this. It seemed to suggest, at least to me, that if it is true that the government is seeking this kind of deal, that there is perhaps some buyer's remorse when it comes to Brexit and its economic impact, I think, which we are starting to feel, or not starting to feel, have already been feeling of late. But I think given especially the recession that's underway, the autumn statement that we heard last week, I think there has been a lot of focus as to what's caused all this. And I think the sort of elephant in the room is the B word.
The FT has also confirmed the story. It says it has spoken to officials who say the Swiss comparison over closer relations has been made in senior government circles. That's the quote. And the Mail this morning, Monday, splashes a warning, don't betray us on Brexit. So the press is certainly taking it seriously. Commentators are pointing out that this is very similar to May's Chequers deal, which was roundly rejected by the Conservatives, even at a time when there were many more Remainers among them who have now been purged. But has there been a shift in mood more generally?
It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, especially off the back of obviously kind of having just seen tweets of Brexiteers criticizing it. I mean, it's certainly hard to imagine the Tories sort of wanting to go back in time and relitigating this issue again.
Are tweets from Brexiteers, though, kicking against this story make it less likely, or do they confirm that they think this is a serious possibility? Do you see what I mean? They could be taken either way.
No, it's true for sure. I mean, it's sort of baffles the mind that Downing Street, obviously Rishi Sunak has just come in and wants to maintain some semblance of unity, going back to Brexit and sort of relitigating, even though, of course, you have things like the Northern Irish Protocol. It's not like Brexit has been done and dusted completely, but to kind of go back and relitigate this issue and to dust up Theresa May's old Chequers deal just feels like kind of the opposite way of getting any sort of unity. It's interesting. I don't know. I'd be keen to see sort of, how many MPs within the Conservative Party feel that perhaps it's time to look to something a bit closer. I mean, I'd also really keen to hear comment from the EU on this, because, you know, the kind of sort of bespoke relationship that Switzerland has with the European Union. I mean, as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, they pay a lot into the EU budget. They allow freedom of movement. These are all things that I think would probably cause a bit of ire within the Conservative benches.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting that it comes sort of after a few days where prominent people, including Jeremy Hunt and the governor of the Bank of England, have openly acknowledged that Brexit has done economic damage. Mm. And there was a YouGov poll showing the highest gap now between people who believe Brexit was a mistake and people who still believe it was the right thing to do. It's now 56% to 32%, which is the biggest sort of gap that we've seen in this kind of tracker poll. My own feeling is that I guess this has been discussed behind closed doors. That doesn't make it a viable plan politically, but I guess at a time when Conservatives are looking for low-hanging economic fruit because the country's economy is in so much trouble, it doesn't surprise me that they would look at a slightly closer relationship, slightly freer access to the EU, because we know that that would boost, you know, GDP and trade and productivity pretty instantly, because we've seen the effect it had when you sort of put up those barriers. So it stands to reason that removing some of those barriers via whatever mechanism would give us an instant little boost. But who knows? Trying to second guess the Conservative Party's action, that way lies madness, I think. Now, the debate on last week's budget this week moves into the Commons Chamber and moves very much from the general to the specific. You wrote that Britain seems to be embracing austerity 2.0. But is this the public or just Conservative politicians? And if there's a gap between the two, how will that play out?
I think it's definitely politicians. You know, I wasn't here in 2010, but it was my understanding just from reading coverage of that time and listening to those who were involved in it reflect on that period, that especially after the financial crisis, I think there was, correct me if I'm wrong, an acceptance among the British population that perhaps some belt tightening had to be done. It doesn't feel like that's the case this time around. I think people are obviously quite fearful of the implications of significant spending cuts, and obviously the implications for tax rises, especially among households who are already feeling the pinch, especially when it comes to things like energy bills. So yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely room for a clash when it comes to sort of public perceptions of what needs to be done and the role that the government has to play to balance Britain's budget, so to speak, and what the government thinks that they have to do, particularly when it comes to reassuring international markets. I think, you know, you have to feel for the British people. And of course, both of us living here, the amount of uncertainty and political upheaval over the past year, then to be followed by, of course, these warnings of, you know, income tax thresholds being frozen, meaning that we're very likely going to pay significantly more tax. And also bracing for the fact that come April, barring those who the poorest households will probably need the support the most, and those on benefits, we're probably also going to see our energy prices go up to the market price. So yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely room for some conflict there.
I've been interested. I mean, I think Hunt and Sunak will be overall delighted with the reaction, right? Because it could have gone a lot worse. But it seems to me to be slowly unraveling. There are budgets that kind of fall apart the day after, and there are budgets that slowly unravel. And this one seems to me to be the latter. There are a lot of noises off from low-tax Tories. I think councils having to increase their poll tax has not gone down particularly well. It seems to me the Telegraph's Dominic Penner is reporting that a number of Tory backbenchers, their local associations, are seething with anger and disbelief, one tells him. because this seems a rather, I guess, unconservative budget. And many people commented on that, I think, when it was announced. It seemed quite a New Labour-ish budget. So we will see how that goes down with grassroots and MPs when the actual debate happens this week. I will be looking very closely to what interventions which backbenchers make. It will be interesting to see. It also has moved slightly the debate onto Labour being pressed to say how they would do it. They're, of course, saying we're not going to write, you know, our manifesto 2 years early.
Mm-hmm.
But they have announced a plan to reform or probably abolish the House of Lords, which was quite a surprise to me. What do you think of that? Is it a smart move politically?
Yeah, I was a bit surprised about it as well, just because, you know, it's not something that in the time that I've lived here, you know, I've obviously heard murmurs about, you know, whether the House of Lords was really, you know, kind of a good sort of democratic thing to continue to have this idea of politicians appointing people to be, you know, peers for life. But yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised to see it. But I mean, you know, the framing that Starmer used was interesting. I believe the story was first reported by The Observer. And when it did, they said that, you know, the way Starmer explained the move is that he wanted to restore trust in politics and to replace the House of Lords with this newly elected chamber. I think the specifics of what that would look like, I think we're still waiting to see, especially in terms of how it kind of relates to the House of Commons. I kind of would be curious to see how such a new chamber, I mean, in terms of whether they would sort of have the same role that the House of Lords does now in terms of legislation and how it would be different. But I think restoring trust is key because obviously, you know, that was a theme that we heard within Rishi Sunak's speech outside Downing Street. And I think that's because that's been the biggest issue of the last couple of years, right? It's been this notion that, you know, the British people really don't trust and haven't been given much reason to trust their politicians, to stick by their word, to govern in a way that is seen as kind of, you know, abiding by the rules and respectable and abiding by tradition and values. And so I think that is a very interesting way for him to go about framing it, because I think that's obviously, that's going to be the tenor of the debate. I think even a couple of years from now, when there is an election, the question will be, did Rishi Sunak actually restore trust in politics? And if you didn't, Labour can be like, look, you haven't been able to trust your politicians for a while. You should trust us.
Finally, there's a developing story about a migrant who was being held at Manston, many say unlawfully, who died over the weekend.
Mm.
Do we know anything except sketchy details about this?
We're getting more details emerging. Of course, it's a terribly sad story. I believe it was the Sunday Times that reportedly the man died of organ failure after being kept in Manston with this processing center in Kent for a week. We know, of course, from the previous reporting that's been done on this, Manston, I think, has become pretty famous after it was revealed recently that I think some 4,000 migrants were being held there, despite the fact that it only had a capacity, I believe, for about 1,000 to 1,600 people. Suella Braverman, of course, came under a lot of criticism for that.
Yeah, and no facilities right, for them to stay more than 24 hours, right? There aren't even beds there.
Right, and in pretty, I think one could argue, inhumane conditions. I think that, you know, there were reports of diseases spreading there. I mean, it doesn't sound like it would be the sort of place where, you know, if you're meant to only be keeping people there for 24 hours, it certainly isn't the sort of place that would be comfortable for someone staying a week, no less, if they're suffering from a serious medical condition, as we can perhaps imagine that this gentleman was. We don't know a lot about him, except for the fact that he reportedly came from the Middle East and had traveled to the UK as part of a small boat crossing. But yeah, I mean, I think this just once again highlights the crisis that's happening there at Manston and sort of, I think, casts a critical light on how the UK is dealing with the migrants that are coming onto their shores.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory,
Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Moving to the other side of the Atlantic, it is wretched to start once again with a homophobic attack, this time in Colorado. What's the summary of the story, Yasmin?
Yeah, it was terrible news to see over the weekend. There was unfortunately another mass shooting in the United States, this time at a gay nightclub in Colorado Springs, that unfortunately resulted in the deaths of 5 people. And it's been reported that at least 25 others were injured. In this case, the gunman, it was a gunman who's been identified, a 22-year-old man who has been detained. He was actually subdued by 2 of the club's patrons. They're still trying to determine the motive, though I think that everything we know about the attack, of course, thus far suggests that it has all the appearances of a hate crime. I mean, you know, I think for a lot of Americans and even international observers, this incident is painfully reminiscent of the 2016 massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida. That, of course, resulted in 49 people being killed and scores of others wounded. Of course, you know, gun laws have not changed in the United States. Unfortunately, hate crimes like these continue to it was kind of just a reminder, at least for me, when I saw the news, that nothing really has fundamentally changed, unfortunately. And especially now post midterms. I mean, you know, the Biden administration, even when the Democrats did have control of both chambers of Congress, was not able to. I mean, they did pass some legislation with regard to guns. I don't want to say they haven't been able to do anything. However, at the end of the day, these are attacks that still happen rather frequently and unfortunately, unsurprisingly, in the United States. And that, I would imagine, especially given the results of the midterms, is unlikely to change anytime soon.
Post-midterms, which we were talking about, a narrow House majority has finally been confirmed for the Republican Party. It was a red trickle rather than a red wave. How difficult can it still make things for the Biden administration, the GOP having a narrow House majority?
I mean, it undoubtedly makes things more difficult in that the Democrats are going to have more of a challenging time passing legislation than they would have when they held both houses of Congress. And even at the best of times, as we recall, they still had some issues even when they did control both houses. But you know what? The results of the midterms overall, after finally getting confirmation that the Democrats had maintained control of the Senate, lost by a minor majority the House, I thought was kind of interesting, because it felt like Democrats had won the narrative in that the Republicans had underperformed so badly that they were almost kind of able to claim a win whilst also losing one of the houses of Congress. So, I mean, I think for Democrats, this probably represented the least worst outcome for them. You know, they can point to the GOP's lackluster performance as a kind of victory. I think the big question, of course, is what is the Republican Party going to do with their new, albeit wafer thin, power? You know, will they continue to propagate Trump's Stop the Steal narrative? You know, that didn't perform particularly well in the midterms. Or, you know, especially if they're going to face, you know, a public backlash. Or, you know, it kind of remains to be seen. I think the murmurs that we're getting from particularly, I think that the more far right sort of corners of that party is that they really just want to go after Joe Biden. And you know, whether that's investigating him, his family, even potentially trying to impeach him, you know, it seems like they're really kind of focusing on him.
There's also a sort of fascinating implication. I read an interesting piece in your magazine, Time, about the Ukraine consensus fraying on the Republican side, and you wrote that this is a more general danger for the West. What should we do to strengthen resolve on supporting Ukraine? Or is it right to question our choice at this point?
Yeah, I mean, that was the question I had going into reporting that piece. You know, I really wanted to understand just how big of a concern war fatigue is. You know, this notion that, especially with the difficult economic winter set looming, that, you know, people facing higher prices, certainly higher energy bills, that perhaps their support for things like sanctions and continued aid packages to Ukraine might start to diminish. What I found was that the polls in terms of support for Ukraine across the West, both in the US, but also in the UK and France and Germany, is that support is remarkably stable for Ukraine. And that's quite good to see. However, the polls also do bear out that support, when faced with higher energy prices or higher prices at home, support does tend to trickle down a bit. And we see this particularly in the US. I mean, so I had cited some polling in which case I think support for sanctions on Russian energy among Republicans drops to 35% compared to, you know, Democrats and independents, 52% and 45% respectively. That's if, you know, they indeed that support for sanctions if they face higher prices. I put the question of how to strengthen resolve to lawmakers in all the countries I was focusing on. And look, they said two things, which I thought was interesting. This was kind of repeated across the conversations that I had. The first is that the onus is really on Western governments to continue to articulate why they're supporting Ukraine and the importance of doing that for democracy.
Yes, leadership is key, isn't it?
Exactly. But the other thing that they said is that, and I think this kind of goes to your second question of, is it right to question our choices? You know, I spoke to someone in the US who said, no, you've got to treat these questions as legitimate. You know, people are right to sort of question, the economic situation in their countries, but that there are arguments and clear cases to be made for why it is important that we continue to support Ukraine, even if we do face these challenges. And off the back of that, it's also incredibly important that governments do everything they can to shield their populations from the worst effects of these economic repercussions, like, for example, capping energy bills or subsidizing them so that their publics don't experience the highest prices. These are, of course, things that we've seen done here in France and Germany. Similar measures are coming in January. But I think those are the two things that lawmakers are going to have to do repeatedly, continuously articulate why, but also provide the support so that their populations don't feel the worst effects.
Meanwhile, after announcing he will run for president, he who shall not be named has also been allowed back on Twitter. Is this significant? Is the Elon Musk, Donald Trump axis of evil a thing?
I mean, it feels worth noting just at the top that the Elon Musk ran a poll to determine, because of course, this is how we make decisions at Twitter now. He ran a Twitter poll to determine whether Trump should be reinstated. And that poll went to Trump's favor 52-48% because we are stuck with that cursed.
Yeah.
So I blame Britain for this. But yeah, I mean, look, I wasn't terribly shocked. I mean, we knew Musk's views on this anyway. And the fact that Trump has announced his third presidential run, I think, would probably have made the case, at least in Musk's mind, that there was, you know, there was a place for Trump on Twitter. I'm kind of keen to see. I think Trump had actually made public remarks saying that he didn't see any reason to return to Twitter because, of course, he has his own social network, Truth Social, and maybe it would be seen as kind of cheating on his pet project if he goes back to Twitter. But I think without question, of course, Twitter is the bigger platform, and so, you know, I went to check out Trump's account. You can see it now. It is indeed reinstated. His last tweet is from January 8th, 2021. So he hasn't tweeted yet.
Which is interesting in itself. It was just after the Capitol invasion. Okay, now very quickly, Qatar World Cup. It got underway yesterday on Sunday, although England and Wales don't play until later today. What were your first impressions?
Well, I didn't watch the opening ceremonies, and neither did the BBC, it would appear. They actually did. They chose not to broadcast it, choosing instead to kind of, I think, focus on more on the criticisms that I think we've been hearing a lot about Qatar in the recent years and months. Look, I think, you know, I've been talking to friends about this over the weekend because I'm obviously very excited to watch the games and that, you know, of course, England is playing. My home country has returned to the World Cup once again. So I'm excited to watch them play each other on Friday. But, you know, this feels like a weird World Cup. It's happening at a weird time of year. And then you have the background, of course, of all the sort of controversial things about the host country, from, of course, the treatment of migrant workers to their laws against LGBTQ people. It just feels like it kind of feels like anything Qatar was hoping to gain, any sort of soft power was hoping to gain from hosting these games. It kind of feels, I know that there's time, you know, these games have only just started, but it really doesn't feel like this has sort of panned out for them, perhaps in the way that they had hoped. Yeah, I mean, I don't think, certainly among the people I've been speaking to, I don't think anyone's particularly excited. But of course, you know, people are going to want to support their teams. I did see that Joe Lysa, he had announced that he was going to, he basically called on David Beckham not to be a World Cup ambassador, to basically cancel the multi-million pound deal that he had done with Qatar to promote the World Cup. He gave him a deadline of yesterday and he didn't do it. So he ended up shredding 10,000 pounds.
Maybe. I mean, we have no way of knowing that was real money, right?
I was going to say, I was looking at the colors because I was like, that looks like it was green. So I was like, that looks like American. I did have this question of whether it's real.
I have to say, it looked a little bit like newspaper, but who knows?
Yeah. I would be very surprised. I mean, that was a lot. My initial thought was, why don't you just donate it to charity or something? But it turns out, I mean, I think the whole appeal was if Beckham did back down, he would donate it to charity. But yeah, so I mean, yeah, it feels like, I don't know about you, Alex, it just feels like a bit of a weird World Cup to me.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. And I think the opening ceremony not being shown made it even weirder. Although I have to say, you know, after people like Piers Morgan criticized in highly exaggerated terms the BBC not showing the opening ceremony, someone explained that the time was changed very recently to an earlier time. And the BBC was showing it on iPlayer and you could see it on the red button. They just couldn't change their schedule to accommodate it, or maybe they didn't want to change the schedule to accommodate it. But there has been a recent change of time to the opening ceremony. So maybe there are other reasons that we're not aware of. I mean, I look forward to some of the football. I'm not looking forward to the stuff around the football because I think we just have to stop. We have to stop allowing repressive regimes to sports wash their behavior. We just have to stop it. Mm. It's become such a popular thing to allow these repressive regimes to put on a big show so that everyone can see, you know, how lovely really they are while people die building the stadia and you know, homosexuals are imprisoned and women are oppressed. It's just unsavory. In my view.
But absolutely, yeah.
There it is. COP27 finished a couple of days ago. There was, for the first time, a framework of a deal on damages.
Yeah, so it seemed like pretty significant for a COP that I think people didn't have a lot of, you know, certainly the climate activists I spoke to weren't particularly excited or hopeful about this COP. But for the first time in 30 years of these climate talks, developed countries agreed to provide basically financial support to help rescue and rebuild poorer countries that are stricken by climate-related disasters. I believe it's being known as the Loss and Damage Fund. So, yeah, I think a pretty significant outcome from this COP. Mm. Of course, I think there was a lot of, you know, to kind of match the optimism of that, there was obviously a lot of negativity around the fact that I think little else was probably done in terms of capping emissions, really to keep 1.5 degrees alive. I think Alok Sharma in particular was particularly scathing about the lack of progress there. You know, I think at Glasgow, he said that the pulse of 1.5 degrees was weak. And after this, he said, unfortunately, it remains on life support. Mm. So yeah, worrying times for the climate, but we have agreed a way to at least mitigate or try to deal with its effects.
Okay, perfect. The only other things I would mention to keep an eye on, the Shamima Begum immigration appeal is this week. Remember, she had her British citizenship withdrawn, many believe against the rules, since she was born and grew up here and has never really embraced any other citizenship. Her lawyers will argue that she doesn't pose a security risk, that she was a victim of grooming. The Telegraph thinks that her winning could open the floodgates to returning jihadists. That's a quote. Seems a little exaggerated. It's sure to be contentious and worth keeping an eye on. Also, Rishi Sunak is talking to the CBI today, Monday, given the story about a renegotiated deal with the EU. I think all eyes will be on that this afternoon. Also, a story brewing for early next week, but with impact this week, is there's a dyslexia debate in the Commons on the 2nd of December, moved by Matt Hancock, who is meant to be in the jungle to champion dyslexia. Will he be evicted in time to come back for his own moved debate? Let's see. Yasmin, thanks for getting up early to join me today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Start Your Week, out every Monday morning from The Bunker. We love starting your week, and it's your support that helps us do that. You can back us on Patreon for as little as £3 a month, and you'll get many episodes early, all of them ad-free, bonus merchandise, and a grateful shout-out. And on that note, here is Yasmin with today's roll call of gratitude.
Hello, and thanks from me to Ed Clues, Sarah Green, Emma, Sarah Cotillon, and David Bunce.
This is all from us. We'll see you tomorrow.
Start Your Week from The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreu with Yasmin Sohan and was produced by Kasia Tomashevich and Jacob Jarvis. Audio production was by me, Jay Bailey, with music from Kenny Dickinson. The group editor is Andrew Harrison, and The Bunker is a Podmasters production.